This is the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. There's an ongoing debate about how things got started. You know, all things. Evolution is the prevailing scientific theory, but plenty of people believe God started it all, including some people who believe wholeheartedly in evolution, like our next guest. Samuel T. Wilkinson wrote a book about the source and meaning of life called Purpose: What Evolution and Human Nature Imply About the Meaning of Our Existence. Samuel T. Wilkinson is an assistant professor of psychiatry at Yale University, so an MD. He's also the associate director of the Yale Depression Research Program. Dr. Wilkinson's articles have been widely published and won several awards. Samuel Wilkinson, welcome to the Exchange.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So we start with this ongoing wrestling match between religion and science, and it's one you have felt keenly in your life, as you tell us in the first words of the preface. What were you faced with early in medical school?
Yeah, no, thanks for asking. The impetus to write this book essentially came from an existential crisis I had while I was a medical student. For whatever reason, at this time in my life, I felt this, or I perceived this conflict and the notion that science, and in particular the theory of evolution, threatened the sense that I had, that many have, that, you know, life has purpose and value and meaning. And I kind of underwent an intense period of study and reflection. And on the other side of that period, I came away with what to me was a very satisfying sort of reconciliation. And I wrote the book because I felt that a lot of people had misperceptions about the science, what the science says, what it implies. And I believe how it can provide a framework that there's an overarching purpose and meaning to life.
Explore that a little more, though. The idea that evolution is not equal to some sort of meaning or purpose in life. Is the idea that life itself is a bit of a cosmic accident, is that a bit of a daunting concept for some people?
Yeah, you know, I think this is epitomized well with a quote that I now laugh at, that I didn't laugh at the time, but there's a professor from the mid 20th century who says, you know, in the inevitable march of evolution, life is of profound unimportance, a mere eddy in the primeval slime. So, you know, part of what was really off-putting to me was this notion that our existence is an accident. And there's a lot of emerging evidence that that is not necessarily the case. And in other words, that evolution was not random.
I can see how you would have laughed at times at the primeval slime part of that thing. And yeah, it would be a little bit off-putting. So what we have here with you then is you're a man of science, but you do believe in God. And I wonder if you can explore that with us a bit. Are you thinking about the watchmaker kind, set it up and walk away, or more of an intervener kind of God?
Well, you know, what I lay out here is essentially what might be called the God of maybe Espinoza, is a kind of a first mover. I believe in more than that personally. It's kind of hard to prove that in the same way that you can maybe prove that, you know, a medication works for a given illness. So I kind of stay away from that part and try to stick with what the science says. And then, you know, people can go from there. But again, going back to this point that, you know, evolution is the randomness of evolution. I think this is one of the reasons that it has been controversial for the last century and a half, is that, you know, a lot of people assume that it implies life is just an accident. We're nothing more than tens of thousands of, you know, intricate molecular mutations, or so the thinking has gone. And a lot of people have taken this a step further and concluded, well, there must be no inherent meaning in life. It's all just, you know, a fluke, a lucky fluke, but a fluke nonetheless.
So is the book then intended as a guide for believers to embrace science, or perhaps a guide for trusters of science to find belief?
Well, maybe a little bit of both. I'm hoping that I primarily wrote it for people, mostly people of faith, but, you know, even people without a specific faith, most people believe that, look, you know, there's purpose and value and meaning in life. And I wrote it for them to kind of understand how at least the most up-to-date scientific theories of human nature and origins are not in conflict with that sense that most of us have.
Humans are divided in so many ways, though. The idea that you can get some believers thinking of science and some people in science thinking of belief, is that a hard thing at this moment in history?
It's a bit of a grandiose aspiration, I admit, but I'm hoping that I can bring, you know, some of these camps together a little bit while providing what I think is a more accurate picture of human nature than a lot of us implicitly have.
Samuel T. Wilkinson is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the author of Purpose, What Evolution and Human Nature Imply About the Meaning of Our Existence. Let's come back to meaning again in our existence and talk about this in the context of your work in psychiatry and at the Yale Depression Research Program. Do depression patients often talk of wondering about the meaning of life?
Well, certainly, not necessarily the meaning of life, but certainly meaning in itself. And having a sense that your life has value and purpose, that is inevitably wrapped up with our relationships with other people. It's very hard for people to find a sense of meaning in a solitary situation or circumstance.
So I come back to that question again. I mean, if the creation of life on Earth was random, does that necessarily preclude us finding meaning in it?
Some people would argue no. I would. What I'm trying to frame here is provide a way that there's almost a sense of there's a not just a personal meaning, but a higher order purpose to our existence. And if you want, we can dive right into that. But
yeah, go ahead. Detail it a bit if you would. Yeah.
Well, let's go back to this issue of the randomness, right? So again, this was what was off-putting to me. There's the way this was framed by actually someone who served for a while as the dean of the Yale School of Medicine, where I now work. A man named Lewis Thomas says, "You know, I cannot make my peace with the randomness doctrine. I cannot abide the notion of purposelessness and blind chance in nature. But I do not know what to put in its place for the quieting in my mind." Close quote. So. What the evidence suggests now is that there's a lot more than just randomness. There are these high-order principles that have constrained biology to go in certain ways and not others. And the best evidence for this is the way in which creatures have developed the same structures independently. So I can give an example.
This is convergence, right?
Yes, it's convergent evolution, exactly. Mostly the scientist who, more than anyone else, is responsible for discovering these patterns is a man named Simon Conway Morris, who's at the University of Cambridge in the UK. Going back to what this means is that there are many instances. In fact, most things have developed independently, most biological traits or structures. When you think of, say, for instance, birds, bats, and butterflies, all of them have wings and the capacity for flight, but biologists tell us that through the long course of evolution, each of these creatures developed wings independently. Another example is a form of photosynthesis called C4 photosynthesis, a remarkably complex process that has developed about 60 different times independently. Another example, eyes. You know, we have these remarkable structures by which we perceive the world. All told, the estimates are that eyes have developed independently about 40 times. So you get the sense that it's not just one random thing after the other. There's a pattern here. And there's still a lot we don't know about this, but there may be, you know, some randomness to this. For instance, it may be, you know, the color of eyes you have may be the random reassortment of your parents' genes, but the fact that you have eyes structured in the way that they are seems to be almost an inevitability of the properties of biological matter.
I don't see the term used much these days, but we did talk about intelligent design for a while, and there were similar arguments to what you're talking about here. Do you fit into that intelligent design box?
Well, the underlying philosophy of intelligent design is that there are kind of holes in the evolutionary theory. There are things that don't quite add up, and that's not necessarily wrong, but they will often look for evidence of God in the gaps of our understanding, or what's sometimes called a God of the gaps. The trouble there is that in our history, science continues to fill in these gaps. So my approach to this is not look looking for God in the gaps, but looking for God in the pattern and the overall framework and what it implies about things. So while I'm sympathetic to the cause of intelligent design, this is not the same kind of approach, and we would have a disagreement on the philosophical approach of this sort of discussion.
All right. Samuel Wilkinson is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange from Yale University, the author of Purpose, What Evolution and Human Nature Imply About the Meaning of Our Existence. Let's talk about implications from another camp. I'm not surprised to see Richard Dawkins, evolutionary biologist and atheist, quoted in your book several times, in fact. He and others believe what, basically, about evolution and what it means about the basic nature of humans?
Well, Dawkins believes in evolution, and he believes it's the it is the, you know, the mechanism that is responsible for our mortal existence. And in that respect, I wouldn't necessarily disagree with him. I think as things have changed over the last 60, 70 years, I'm not sure what he would say exactly about human nature now, but in his probably his most popular book, The Selfish Gene, in the opening pages of it, this was published in the 1970s, he declares, you know, if you wish to build a society in which individuals cooperate generously and unselfishly towards another or towards a common good, you can expect little help from biological nature because we are born selfish. And that's another reason I think that the theory of evolution has been controversial, because of what it implies about human nature is, well, at least on the surface, not very encouraging. A few years after Darwin published his most influential book, The Origin of Species, another biologist coined this phrase, survival of the fittest. And biologists don't use that term much today, but it can be instructive. And a lot of us will kind of implicitly think, oh, you know, if evolution is actually responsible for humanity, then at our core, we're selfish. And that's a bitter pill to swallow and a depressing view of human nature. But over time, we've realized that it's a bit more complex than that. And in a somewhat paradoxical way, nature shaped us to have a deep capacity for altruism.
Things like mirror neurons and stuff like that?
Well, I'm referring more at evolutionary mechanisms. So mm-hmm. Let me just give an example to illustrate this a little bit. There's a remarkable story of two shipwrecks at the same time and place. In the 1860s, two ships crashed on the opposite ends of an archipelago called the Auckland Islands. It's located about 300 miles south of mainland New Zealand. Now, the crew from the ships never learned of each other's existence. The islands were vast enough that they never ran into each other. The first vessel, following about 18 months being trapped on this island, all of them, fortunately, were able to survive. The second ship, unfortunately, most of the men from that second ship died. And, you know, what was the key difference? Well, the survivors of the first ship formed a remarkably cohesive group. And this was exemplified in the first few minutes even of the shipwreck, when the captain carried an injured man on his back as he swam through the waves to the safety of the shore. The crew from the second ship, on the other hand, they kind of formed this every man for himself approach. And within the first few days following their shipwreck, they left a wounded man behind to die. So you can kind of see how, you know, it's not hard to imagine scenarios in our distant past where, similar to this example of the shipwrecks, it was altruism and not selfishness that led to, you know, survival. I think this is phrased well by two eminent biologists who said that, you know, selfishness beats altruism within groups, but altruistic groups beat selfish groups, and everything else is commentary. So you can see how, well, yeah, you know, on the one hand, there were probably scenarios that favored selfishness, but on the other hand, survival can be a, you know, a kind of collective goal, and working together can enhance your chances. So in this kind of interesting way, evolution has built within us opposing capacities. And it's not just selfishness and altruism, but a host of other kind of traits that are in opposition: aggression and cooperation, cruelty, kindness. You know, it doesn't take long to think back in the, you know, the history book of humanity that, yeah, you know, human nature is this mix of deep capacities for selfishness, but also altruism. So this is what I call the dual potential of human nature.
We are talking rather deeply about things like evolution and God and how these things might work together, because they do. In our guest's perception, Samuel T. Wilkinson is assistant professor of psychiatry at Yale University, associate director of the Yale Depression Research Program, and the author of a recent book called Purpose: What Evolution and Human Nature Imply About the Meaning of Our Existence. So here again, you believe in evolution, you believe God was there to start it. Do you think, Dr. Wilkinson, we can be moral and make good decisions, or at least decisions that benefit each other and humanity, without God, or at least without religion?
Yeah, that's a good question. Certainly there are a lot of colleagues and friends that I have who have no professed belief in God and are very good people. I think, you know, regardless of creed or religion or race or sex, all of us have a capacity to behave in ways that are helpful for others and ways that are altruistic, but all of us at the same time have a darker propensity to our nature and the capacity to act in ways that are selfish.
And when it comes to things like belief in a higher power, is the point not that we believe in a higher power, but that one believes in us?
Certainly that's part of it. I think, you know, there's been a lack of or a profound decrease in trust in humanity and others. The political polarization in the United States and the kind of the growing tension internationally among previously allied countries is evidence that our collective trust and faith in humanity has decreased. I think both can be helpful. There are certain situations that we can put ourselves in that can help us, I think, to choose the better angels of our nature, to quote Abraham Lincoln.
Well, and in terms of choosing, though, and this is where, I mean, you do not hesitate to open up several cans of worms in the book, and one of them is free will. So
yes.
Where do you come down in thinking that we have free will or don't?
Well, I think there's a lot of evidence to suggest that at least the way that I think about free will is a real phenomenon. It's still a mystery to me as to where that came from in evolution or where it comes from in the development from infancy to adulthood. But there is evidence to show that behavior is not predictable, is not highly determined, even in relatively simple organisms. That's kind of the free part. And there's lots of evidence to show that there is what we might call top-down causation. In other words, that our mental thoughts, our thinking and thought processes influence our behavior. So this is a debate that a lot of people have been having for a long time. I throw my hat into the ring and you know, provide the evidence that I feel justifies the belief that we have free will. By the way, Even if really intelligent people debate this, all of us go around virtually all the time considering ourselves free and responsible entities. And even those who, from philosophy and neuroscience and so forth, that deny free will, they don't go around thinking that. They only think that when they're engaged in these deep, you know, philosophical debates. So, you know, for those who get hung up on that point, you know, there's a chapter that I lay out the evidence to suggest that this is a rational, coherent notion that we have free will. But for most people, I don't think that's going to be a big stumbling block. Virtually everyone has this sense, this experiential notion that we have some ability to choose our actions and therefore be responsible for them.
So to the title of the book, Purpose, I mean, can you define a purpose to life?
Well, I try. And going back to what we discussed a little earlier, is it's very apparent to me, at least, that the way that nature has shaped us has left us conflicted, right? What I call the dual potential of human nature. We have immense capacity for altruism, but also, unfortunately, selfishness. And in theological terms, you might call that good and evil. And when you combine that with the observation, the empirical observation that we have free will, it provides, from my viewpoint at least, a framework that there is a universal purpose, which is to choose between, you know, the good and the evil impulses within us. Life, it seems, is a test. And it can't be a real test unless we are pulled in one direction or the other.
Well, the act of choosing itself, I mean, there are so many examples through human history of acts both wonderful and horrible, and certainly still
Correct.
Daily demonstrations. Does it make people nervous, do you think, to think of their own range of choices and possibilities?
Well, there's some data suggesting that, you know, when you think of yourself in an agential way, what I mean by that is as an agent that can make choices, that can lead to better mental health and better behavior. So I think when we feel like we're trapped and we can't do things, that can be harmful for mental health. And in a way, some people can take that as a bit of an excuse to misbehave when people aren't looking.
All right, so let's get into some of the ways in which evolution indicates perhaps a direction pushing us towards some sort of cooperation. And you get into things like kin selection and group selection. Can you kind of give us a rough sketch of that?
Yeah, it goes back to this example I shared of the shipwreck where, you know, the survival of the group was superior when the group was cohesive and interacting in a cooperative way. Whereas if a group is full of people who are just looking out for themselves, you know, it's going to fall apart and people left to fend for themselves in a nature ridden tooth and claw are going to have a harder time. And from an academic standpoint, just to put in a caveat here, this notion of group selection is a little bit controversial, but kin selection is not, and kin selection is essentially where, you know, the people sharing the same genes, which we know as family members, look out for one another and behave in cooperative ways. And we experience this probably more than any other creature based on the fact that our offspring are so immature when they are born. Some scholars who study infant development refer to the first 3 to 6 months of life as the, quote, fourth trimester, because in essence, our children are born half-baked. They need our help for a long, long time to become mature and responsible and be able to live independently.
Samuel Wilkinson is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the author of Purpose, What Evolution and Human Nature Imply About the Meaning of Our Existence. Sorry, cut you off on a so.
So what that means, and this, you know, is a really interesting concept that because our children are born so helpless, of necessity, we have had to develop a deep sense of love and concern for them. And, you know, this brings together these two principles of love and sacrifice, in essence, that, you know, when you ask a parent, what is the most challenging thing you've done, they'll say 9 times out of 10, well, it's raise my children. And if you ask them what is the most rewarding thing, they'll say 9 times out of 10, we'll raise my children. And those kind of are inevitably, inextricably linked, right? You couldn't necessarily have one without the other. Let me try to drive this point home with just this thought experiment. Imagine how our social lives would be different if we were, say, seahorses. Now, seahorses have male pregnancy, and that would probably lead to some very different parental leave policies. But in addition to that, they have about 2,000 babies. They can birth to 2,000 babies at once. But once their offspring are born, they essentially have no more parental investment in them. And, you know, no one exactly knows what it's like to be a seahorse, but it's a good bet that they don't really have a deep love or concern for their children because they just kind of say, okay, good luck. You know, I hope you make it and pass on my genes. Whereas if you flip this back into humans, you know, we have had to have developed this deep love and concern and altruism toward our offspring. And some people may think that's a little bit cynical, right? I only love my children because they have my genes. And I would frame it and say, well, that's how nature created you. That's how you were created.
So in terms of feeling like we're doing good things in our lives, it sounds like you're saying families, and then I don't know if there's necessarily have to be biological families or the families we create amongst groups of friends. This would seem to be the cornerstone for making humanity more human.
I think that's right. When you ask people what makes life meaningful, they mostly point to personal relationships more than work. More than status, although we seem to have a part of us that craves status or money and so forth, but those things often don't have the same enduring satisfaction that relationships bring. And certainly the relationships among family members are really critical. One of the key findings from sociological literature is that when we link men to their children, they behave in better ways. And I think there's a strong kind of evolutionary explanation for why that is. It's because the strongest forms of altruism have developed with respect to the ways that nature has shaped family relationships.
You say in the book, no other species matches us humans and the cruelty we sometimes show to each other. And I wonder if aggression or abuse or cruelty have a, contagious element or something. And in what context would you place times of increasingly aggressive human behaviors? And is this one of them?
Well, I think yes. And there are a lot of factors that contribute to that. One is let's just take the internet, for instance. The anonymity that exists in the internet can fuel the mistreatment of each other when we see ourselves not necessarily as humans, but as objects. Now, this has to do with, the fact that you can create usernames that have no real linkage to your identity. And this is kind of the same principle that happens with road rage. So, road rage is a phenomenon, but pedestrian rage isn't really. And why is road rage a thing? It's because subconsciously, if we forget that inside that large metal box on wheels, there's actually a human being. It's not that we, of course, consciously forget it, but our subconsciousness, forgets that that's a human being. And so when we interact in ways that are completely anonymous, there's some context in which the anonymity can be helpful. There are often aspects in which it is harmful, and we will say things over the internet and so forth that we would never say to a person's face.
So do you have some ideas as we close here? You've got about a minute and a half left for how we can right the human ship, get past what appears to be an outbreak of I'm not taking your crap anymore without getting to world war or something like that.
Well, I think one of the ways we can do that is to have a deeper understanding of human nature. A lot of times in this politicized world, we're tempted to view the world as comprised of people who are fully good or fully evil. And this is wrong, and it can lead to dangerous ideologies. The world is full of people, all of whom have both strengths and weaknesses. Each one of us is a complicated mix of good and bad. And my experience as a psychiatrist, as well as a pastor, have convinced me most people are trying to do what is right, but it's a struggle. Sooner or later, for all of us, the pull of selfishness is strong. And so contrary to what we might infer from the culture is that, the point of life is not to point out weaknesses of your spouse, your neighbor, or even your political opponent, but the point of life is to point out and overcome our own weaknesses. But it's hard work, and we ought to be patient with ourselves and with each other.
We started out talking about your entry into medical school and the existential crisis that gave you. How long have you worked on this book?
Well, I've wanted to write it for almost 15 years. I had to put it on the shelf for about 10 or 12 years while I finished my medical training and picked it back up right as COVID started. And it's been a challenge, but it's been immensely rewarding.
Well, thank you for sharing it with us. Samuel T. Wilkinson is an assistant professor of psychiatry at Yale University, the associate director of the Yale Depression Research Program, as you heard, a pastor as well. His book is Purpose, What Evolution and Human Nature Imply About the Meaning of Our Existence. Dr. Wilkinson, thank you so much for sharing this on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.